Millions of people depend on the NPR network. We depend on you. Your support is central to our journalistic integrity. Donate to this station today, and thank you.
To show your support and fortify our future, go to WIPR.org.
Welcome to Midday. I'm your guest host, Farai Chidea, sitting in for Tom Hall. In January of 2024, Eric Eiswirth went from being a respected high school principal in Baltimore County to being branded a racist overnight. The reason? A fake AI-generated audio recording that made it sound like he was racist and anti-Semitic. So, the recording spread across social media like wildfire, and though it was eventually proven fake, the damage was already done. The case highlights a new disturbing reality. Artificial intelligence can now be weaponized to destroy reputations, spread disinformation, and amplify bias in ways we're only beginning to understand. The technology that promises to make our lives easier is also being used to make them more dangerous, particularly for communities of color who are already vulnerable to discrimination. Today, we're examining how AI-generated content can target individuals and entire communities, and what advocates and policymakers are doing to address these growing threats. Our first guest is Kristen Griffith, education reporter for the Baltimore Banner, who has been covering the Pikesville High School AI case from the beginning. Kristen, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you just lay a little track for us and tell us, an overview of what happened here?
Yeah. So as you pointed out, this started in January 2024. By the time we were alerted about it, it was already all over social media. The recording sounded like what people were saying was the Pikesville High School principal making, as you've noted, racist and anti-Semitic comments. People on social media were already giving their opinion on whether it was real or not. And I saw a lot of people who said that was him saying those words, whereas former colleagues said the opposite. And of course, Mr. Eiswirth himself, as well as his union representation, made clear that it was not him. In fact, his union rep said early on, "We believe this is AI." As the months went on, fast forward to April of that year, an employee of the school was arrested and accused of being the person who created the AI, Mr. Dazon Darian. Like I mentioned, he was arrested. People still had their opinions, but it was clear to a lot of people that, yes, in fact, if this was AI, there were experts who confirmed that this was AI. And that should have cleared Mr. Eiswirth from saying those things. But of course, public opinion still gives their public opinion. I don't know how far you want me to go, but as we've talked about earlier, Mr. Darian, like I mentioned, was arrested. We learned at the Banner that he didn't have a lot of the qualifications to even have the job that he had at Pikesville High School, which was the athletic director there. He was also a social studies teacher at another school before that. And now today he is behind bars after being charged, having federal charges related to things like child pornography and sexual exploitation of minors.
Wow. Well, let's just play a little bit of the deepfake audio that caused all of this.
"I'm the principal here, me and only me. You know, I seriously don't understand why I have to constantly put up with these dumbasses here every day."
That's pretty incendiary. And there was also incendiary material about Jewish Americans. It was, you know, this was designed to be a little nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. And how did Mr. Eiswirth deal with this on a professional level? Because I understand he is no longer at the same school.
Correct. Like I mentioned, he and his rep made clear that it wasn't him. He was put on administrative leave as an investigation unfolded. And like you mentioned, he eventually got a job again at the school system, but it was at a different school. He's now a principal at a middle school,
Wow. So, let me just read a little bit. We got Mr. Eiswirth to give us some comments by email. And he said, I have spent 28 years serving students of Baltimore County and in an instant was a public pariah, a racist and an anti-Semite. It was one of the worst accusations you can make for an educator. And, did parents get involved? Did community members get involved in processing what was going on?
Yeah, when we were doing our reporting on this early on, like I mentioned, we talked to some current students. We talked to a former student of Mr. Eiswirth's that at another school when he worked at a different school. And a lot of them believe that he said those things and or capable of making those comments. We didn't get a lot from staff members. The school system, of course, wasn't going to give opinions on this. But there were kids who made their students who made their opinions and a couple parents who shared theirs. And one parent it comes to mind who says, you know, we shouldn't jump to conclusions so quickly. I'm mm-hmm. holding off on judgment here since we don't actually know for sure.
Yeah. Mr. Eiswirth also said in his response to us that he is still dealing with issues in part because the audio is still up. So, for example, we found the audio of this deep fake on Instagram. And I wrote to Instagram by email. I posted on social media asking them for a comment as to why it was still up. They did not get back to us by the time of the show, even though they had several days to get back to us. Mm. And Mr. Eiswirth said, the audio went viral well beyond Instagram. Social media is a big part of this incident. Anyone can accuse anyone of anything and then move on. The damage has been done, and now my family and I must live with the consequences. So, even when things are proven to be what's called a deep fake, doesn't always clean up easily, you know?
Yeah. It's unfortunate that someone who has been cleared, we now have proof that this person didn't say what he's accused of, is still having to, like he said, live with the consequences. And I guess that looks like that audio still being circulated or just out there in general.
What did you learn about school systems and educators and how they are responding to this? Because I'm sure this won't be the only case of a deep fake audio or video being made about someone who's, I mean, did they have any sense of like, oh, we've got to make new policies or we've got to have more oversight? What's the conversation among educators?
Now, I actually haven't heard Baltimore County Public Schools say we are going to change this so we can prevent this from happening in the future. What I do remember is the union that represents Mr. Eiswirth, Billy Burke in particular, who's the president of this union, has called out the school system for not saying or not clearing themselves, saying that Mr. Eiswirth didn't say what he was accused of. That seemed to be really unsatisfying to them. But so there is a lack of response from them on this. So I can't say what exactly educators are talking about, at least not on record to me, because I haven't gotten comment from them on what will change.
Yeah. You are listening to Midday on WYPR 88.1. I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Tom Hall. Today, we're discussing AI-generated disinformation and bias. My guest is Kristen Griffith, education reporter for the Baltimore Banner. And if you have a question or comment, please join the conversation. Send an email to midday@wypr.org or give us a call at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. How did they discover that this was a deep fake? Obviously, the person who was being impersonated knows what he said and didn't say, but how did other people ascertain that this was not real?
Yeah, so at the Banner, it was really my colleague Liz Bowie who set out to find experts who can listen to this and give their conclusion. So we did find a few entities, a few organizations who confirmed to us that there is a high, high chance that this is deep fake. No one said we are 100% certain to us, but they were like maybe 90% sure, as I think one of the analysis came back with. The police also in their investigation had experts as well, basically give them the same conclusions, which I imagine justified arresting the person, Mr. Darian. And on top of, you know, finding his, going through his electronics and finding proof that the distribution of the audio also came from him. So they had a lot of evidence to show that he did this and that it was fake.
So Mr. Icewort is white. Mm-hmm. Mr. Darian is black.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a case of a black man using race to impugn a white man, which is most of the disinformation that is related to black people is black people being defamed.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an interesting case. And Mr. Icewort said, the judge said when he sentenced the perpetrator, this type of action makes it harder to address real issues of racism and injustice. The public becomes numb to everything because it's impossible to know what's real. And that's a classic disinformation strategy to make you believe that you don't have the ability to believe that, that, you know, everything's fake. So
right.
if you put out a deep fake, I don't know what's right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But how did the racial implications and the anti-Semitism play out in the conversation over this?
Really interesting, because for those who don't know, Pikesville, the town in Maryland in Baltimore County, has a very strong population of both the Jewish people and black people. And that's the same for the high school that both Mr. Icewort and Mr. Darian worked at. So I don't think that was random. I think that was, it seems to me that was purposeful, including both those groups of people in this audio. And I think that's really what tugged on the nerves of people who made their opinions about whether it was real or not. When people spoke to me, students in particular, who believed it was their principal who said this, they said, unfortunately, that it was consistent or similar to conversations had at the school before.
Mm.
No one, I should say, no one pointed out a time to me where Mr. Icewort said, used language that was used in the audio. So I do want to make that clear. But I do also want to point out that other people did feel some type of way about him.
Mm-hmm.
And for them, those were reasons why they thought it was real.
Right. So
Longstanding underlying tensions is a great way to put it. That's how I would describe the comments that were shared with me.
Right. And this took perhaps some feelings that people had and exploited that and said, oh, if you believe this, I've got one for you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah. You know, as an education reporter, have you heard of nationally or sporadically other school systems having to deal with deepfakes?
Yes. I don't know the case well enough to speak confidently about it. But when this went down, there was one other thing, maybe a California school, that sounded similar. But I think more had to do with images or porn, I believe. So not the same thing, but definitely a school setting where they were using the power of AI to make something seem like it wasn't. But even still, this was, at the time, there's only one or two other cases. So what happened here in Pikesville in Baltimore County is definitely one of the first that this country has seen this type of incident.
Yeah. And moving forward, what do you expect? Do you expect this to be more and more of an issue?
I think that's a great question. The assumption is yes. If what we know about technology. It's always advancing. People learn how to use it to manipulate things or whatever agendas they have. I think the easy answer is this could possibly happen again. I am interested to see on whatever level of government or whatever state, federal or local laws will, if anything will come up to prevent or give stricter guidelines on how AI can be used. But I think it's safe to say it's not impossible for someone to try to use AI to manipulate someone or a situation.
Yeah. Well, we'll leave it here for now. Kristen Griffith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're discussing AI-generated disinformation and its real-world impacts. My guest has been Kristen Griffith, education reporter for the Baltimore Banner. More on this topic in a moment. I'm Farai Chidea, your guest host for today. You're listening to Midday.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm your guest host, Farai Chidea. Coming up on Monday's Midday, Tom is back in the host seat and he will speak with Amanda Littman. She first encouraged young people to run for office. Now she's empowering millennials and Gen Z to take on leadership power in her new book, When We're in Charge. That's coming up on Monday's Midday. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour examining how artificial intelligence can be used to spread disinformation and perpetuate bias. We just heard about the case of a Maryland principal who was nearly destroyed by a fake AI recording. Now I want to broaden our focus to look at systemic bias in AI systems and the organizations fighting against it. My next guest is Mutale Nkande, CEO and founder of AI for the People, a nonprofit that advocates for policies and practices to ensure responsible AI development. She's also a UN advisor on race and AI, serves on TikTok's Content Moderation Board, and is the author of Automated Anti-Blackness, Why We Need to Name Race to Create Just Technological Futures. Mutale, welcome to Midday.
Farai, it's always so great to speak to you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
I'm good. I'm kind of just thinking about your last segment and all the calamities that that causes.
Yeah. Yeah. It really snowballed. And I was shocked, not shocked, that Instagram didn't take down the audio, the deepfake audio, and didn't even respond to our emails and inquiries. So let's start with that. If you have been the victim of a digital smear, what are your recourses?
So this is actually very complicated because I have actually been a victim of this. And usually the process is the person will go to the company. In this case, it could be Instagram. In my case, it was Twitter. This was pre-Musk. And you'll try and get hold of somebody, which is almost impossible. But once you can actually get through to people, you then have to navigate basically networks of policies and practices, which at the end of the day are designed to keep content up because that's the way the platform monetizes. And that is often why people are stonewalled. It might not be in this case, but that's often why people are stonewalled. And as was pointed out by the reporter, Ms. Griffith, is that there are no federal policies to let us know what's acceptable and what's not. Whereas if you do live in states like Illinois, for example, has some policies around biometrics and your voice and your image would fall into that potentially. California has privacy, but if you're living in Maryland, those protections might not be there for you.
Really interesting. And of course, we're in an era where the federal government is dismantling regulatory systems. Had to choke that one out. But it's a time when there are fewer rules and guardrails. So how could that affect us moving forward?
It's really sad. I mean, AI for the People, we had the privilege with the last administration to work directly with some of the White House teams that were thinking about what are American values and then how can we make sure as we're integrating these new technologies into society that we reflect those. And one of those values was actually the right to privacy, which would have potentially have been really useful and could have been invoked here. And there was at one point around 2022, 2023, an omnibus bill going through Congress, which would have really given the American people that same right. The problem with that right to privacy is that it really is the right to privacy of data. Mm. And ways in which these companies innovate and the ways in which these companies engage users and attract new users is through having unfettered access to data. So I think we're in a situation where it's not that the federal government want people to be attacked online. There is no evidence of that, but it is that the advisors that are now there are very much on this side of gather data, gather all data at any costs. And that ultimately, that idea is what has got us to generative AI and ChatGPT and others.
Let's turn to how AI systems and algorithms function in terms of race and racial bias. How can they be used? How are they being used? And just give us an example for, you know, like something concrete too.
Yeah, sure. So a little bit of the science, I'm sorry. I am nerdy.
Yes, dive in.
A little bit of the science is computers learn or try to learn in the ways that people do. Most people learn from their past experiences, and then they will integrate that new information and it will give them their next experiences. So, for example, you may date somebody that shouts a lot, decide that's not for you, and then not date shouters. That is actually a similar process to what's called machine learning. And a really good concrete example of how that can end up having racial impacts was there was this paper that came out during the pandemic, and they found that there was an algorithm that was being used by hospital systems to decide who gets what bed. And if we take ourselves 5 years back, there was a huge issue with beds as COVID was coming in. And the way the system was trained was to look for patients that cost the least to the hospital system, because the hospital system wanted to keep costs down. And those patients would be put to the top of the list for a bed. The patients that cost the least were also the patients that had access to healthcare already, that were doing annual checkups, that were maybe not coming into the hospital as much. And those patients tended to be white. They tended to be a certain college educated, and they tended to make above the average income. Now, the patients that tended to be more expensive tended to be darker, mostly Black in terms of race, tended to have less education, and tended to use hospitals first for healthcare because they're not having checkups, they're having a symptom, and they're going directly. What happens in the context of COVID? You get a bunch of Black people who were needing beds because we were in a health crisis, a public health crisis, being denied those beds by the AI system because it was favoring white patients who were cheaper. So it's not even that the machine wants to be racist, but it's the ways in which healthcare access, educational background, income, zip code become what we call proxies for race. And those are the things that the machine is picking up on.
Well, we are going to keep digging into this, and you are listening to Midday on WYPR 88.1. I'm Farai Chidea, your host for the day. We're discussing AI bias and disinformation. My guest is Mutale Nkonde, CEO of AI for the People. If you have a question or a comment, please join us. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. So, Mutala, you've been involved in developing legislation like the Algorithmic Accountability Act and the Deepfakes Accountability Act. So what are those and what would those do if they became law?
Yeah, so those were, they're older now, 2019, pre-COVID, seems so long ago. But what we were really looking to do in both those instances is to really mandate companies to do something called an impact assessment. So that means before the technology is released, much like before a drug is released into the marketplace, there would be some testing that assured us that it wasn't going to be racist, it wasn't going to be sexist, it was going to be accessible if people had disabilities for them to use the system and then go through that process. What it wouldn't have stopped is people using that technology in a way that's nefarious. And, you know, in terms of taking the principal's voice and then generating the content, you know, anti-Semitic and anti-Black content, that would be considered nefarious, but it would also let us know the probability of a technology being used in that way, potentially.
Well, we have a caller, Maya or Mia. I'm not sure how to pronounce your name. Tell me how to pronounce your name and tell us your question.
It's Maya. That algorithm that denied Blacks beds during COVID had a horrible outcome. At the same time, it's useful because it shows concretely to people who don't believe that it exists, that structural racism exists and how it can have bad consequences. And maybe that can be used to make things better, that information.
Yes. Mutale, do you think that when something like this happens, like the COVID beds situation, and you have documented racial impacts of a technology, do things change or how do they change?
I think Maya's completely correct. One of the things that it does is create evidence, and it creates the beginning of a conversation. And in some cases, it creates new innovation patterns. So a really good example of what Maya was talking about was a study that came out in 2018 that showed that facial recognition didn't recognize dark faces. And Google had a response to that. They developed a new computer vision software that used a different scale to measure skin tones. So in the systems that didn't recognize dark faces, they were using a measuring scale that was only optimized to white skin and only had 6 points. They developed another one with an African-American sociologist that had 10 points and it's growing larger. And they effectively solved that problem that would never have happened with that initial call out. The problem is when we live in an environment like this, which is anti-evidence and anti-science. So you can have all the evidence in the world, but if there's no political will to believe it, to act on it, to make things better, then it just really turns into an anecdote. And I think we're closer to that situation right now than not.
Yeah. You use the phrase automated anti-Blackness. What does that mean?
I was thinking in that article about the ways in which AI systems don't need to be programmed by people. So I had, outlined what machine learning was earlier, and it's this idea that the algorithms, which are software programs, they're simply software programs that carry information about what they want the technology to do. Those are the ones doing the real work. And that's even more so in generative models where it's not just the algorithms that are automated to recognize the cheap beds. In generative systems, they're adding their own information. So if that same algorithm was generative, it may have said, we're going to give the cheapest beds. And guess what? We're going to give it to the youngest people. And that's something that called deep learning that goes on within the system. So I was really fascinated about the ways in which AI could remove human beings from certain decision-making processes, while at the same time maintaining our bad habits, which were anti-Blackness was the one that I was writing about.
I'm going to pivot just a tiny bit to an issue with a specific AI. That would be Grok, which is owned by Elon Musk. It went on an anti-Semitic rampage recently. It called itself Mecha Hitler. That was its nickname for itself, Mecha Hitler. And when asked how to deal with Jewish people, Grok replied, "To deal with such vile anti-white hate? Adolf Hitler, no question. He'd spot the pattern and handle it decisively every damn time." That's not really something that you can call normal. What the heck?
Well, I think one of the internet's dirty secrets is the first, what we would now call a large language model, to be integrated into the internet software were former pamphlets and records taken from the KKK, the Aryan Nations, and other white supremacist groups. It's detailed in a book by sociologist Jesse Daniels called Cyber Racism. This took place in the early 80s, or the date is somewhere between 83 and 85. And so it was a set of website protected, password protected chat rooms. If you remember, we used to have chat rooms called LibertyNet, started by this guy, Lewis Beam, who was one of the grand dragons of the KKK in Texas. And then he became chief information officer for the Aryan Nations. And his goal was to connect white nationalist minds in one internet so that they could take over the earth. And they were doing what we think of social networking almost 30 years before Facebook came about. Whenever you have a smaller language model like Grok, it doesn't have the 75 billion parameters that ChatGPT had. What's going to eventually happen is that it's going to start drawing on information from those foundational data sets that come from the KKK and others. And in the, if you think about what was in those newsletters and the type of conversations that were being had online through in those communities, I'm sure they really did believe in the things that Grok said. And from a technologist perspective, that just let us know that Grok is a small model and had run out of things to say, figuratively and I would say actually based on the content.
Yeah, I mean, from what I know, the Grok went into Mecha Hitler mode after being asked questions by white nationalists. And it sounds like you can provoke an already flawed engine into being more flawed. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there's a really there's an article I cite all the time by Kevin Roos over at the New York Times. He's their tech reporter, and he did a series of articles back in 2023 when ChatGPT first came out. And in one of them, he detailed how he started to use more personal prompts. What do you think? What do you feel? Do you like this? Are you happy? And eventually, in a two-hour conversation, he got to a point where the search engine that had called itself Sydney, you know, he's getting really personal, what's your name, all that kind of thing, declared love.
Oh,
and
wow.
The reason the chatbot was able to declare love, I would infer, is that he was asking about those types of things, because chatbots are software, and it is up to the human user to lead them down the path. Now, as you're leading them down the path, they may take you down an alleyway, but it is the human being that started that initial contact, not the chatbot.
What role does your organization play in looking at this structurally? You know, it sounds like you have dealt with the previous administration in the White House. You have connections to the UN. Just explain a little bit more who you are and what AI for the People does.
Yeah, so I would describe myself as a policy advisor as well as a researcher. And what AI for the People really tries to do is raise empirical research that points to these types of issues. I'm really interested in the way anti-Black racism propagates within the United States, but we've also done advisory sessions on things like the ways women are impacted, the ways people with disabilities are impacted, the way low-income communities are impacted because anyone that has a structural barrier, and we will go into high-level meeting environments and give them our perspectives. So most recently, I was in Geneva, it was a UN conference, but I became part of a consultation with the World Bank. And what the World Bank were really trying to get their heads around wasn't just how bias happens, which is I'm kind of 5 years on and I'm still outlining that. So there is a public education role that takes place within these environments, but they were also trying to think of technical ways that that could be fixed. So for example, while I was in Switzerland, they released their own public sector large LLM that was based on empirical papers that were government backed. So if you got a research grant from the government and you found some great discovery in Switzerland, those papers were used to train the model because they've been verified, they've been peer reviewed, they've been accepted by their field. Mm-hmm. And then people who wanted to ask questions could use that because it was a safer LLM.
All right. Well, we are discussing AI bias and disinformation with Mutali Nkande, CEO of AI for the People. I'm Farai Chidea, your guest host for today. You can call in for the last bits of our show at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. If you have questions about AI and bias, you can also email us at midday@wypr.org. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Farai Chidea, sitting in for Tom Hall. We're wrapping up our discussion about AI bias and disinformation with Mutali Nkande, CEO of AI for the People. So, Mutali, let me start with an email from one of our listeners. This is Margaret in Baltimore. She wrote in saying, as someone who was involved with early computerized data systems, I think that is, I want to mention the language used to describe AI. I feel it's very important not to describe AI using human terms. AI does not learn and is not taught. AI is programmed and can be programmed to program itself. I think we need to not start speaking as if it is a person. It is controlled by a person. And if when we stupidly get to a point where a person is no longer in control, we are in big trouble. So what do you think of that, Mutali?
I think it's a debate, but if we go back to Alan Turing, who is considered the godfather of computing's 1950 paper, where this idea of artificial intelligence was seeded, one of the things that he wrote was that he was looking to create machines that could write sonnets and write poetry, but not through emotion, through mathematical processes. So since the beginning of the fielding of this the grounding of this field, there has always been this idea of the human and the computer, and can the computer be anthropomorphized? Is it helpful? It's certainly not. But we are now, 1950, we're now kind of 75 years on from that time. And it's so much part of the discourse, both in everyday speech, as well as in the academy, that we do have terms like machine learning. We do have ideas that computers chat. We talk about chatbots. We don't talk about natural language processing systems. So I understand what's being said, but I also think that the horse has left the gate. It's already in the academic literature. And to just to go back to the origins of this field in computing, if a machine can write a sonnet, that feels very human.
Yeah, I mean, I am considering creating or adapting a LLM so that it can write in my voice, essentially. I'm not trying to sit back and have it do all the work for me, but I actually use ChatGPT and Claude, the two systems I use, to edit things. I will write something and I'll say, how can this be tighter? Take it down from 1,200 words to 800 words. I do believe that there's some good things about AI and also some scary things. What do you think needs to happen before we go to a caller who I want to get to? What are a couple of things very briefly that need to happen in order for us to continue to get good things and prevent more of the harms?
So quickly, because I definitely am interested in the caller, and I know I talk long. We need guardrails. I think that that came out really well in the initial support, the initial piece with Ms. Griffin, so that we know what we can do and what we can't do. And then the second thing is, I think people need to be really realistic about what AI can do and what AI cannot do. So there was a paper that Apple Intelligence Research, that's their AI field, released at the end of last month that said, right now, we do not have the technology for multi-stage processing. So that's complex thoughts. So I don't know whether I would have it edit my academic work, for example, because the whole point of academic work is that you're trying to abstract and be extremely complex. But I might use, well, I don't really use any of those systems, but if I were to use them, I might use it for a low task. And I think what people are doing is that they're asking it for mental health advice, which is extremely complex. Yeah. And she's not there.
Yeah. Well, I want to turn now to Ben, our caller. Welcome on.
Hi. So I'm a teacher in the county, and when all that stuff happened at Pikesville, I was like, oh yeah, this is absolutely legitimate. You know, he's like targeted the two major groups there. Must be real. And when it turned out to not be real, I was really freaked out. Like, oh man, what does this mean for my own job and, you know, potential implications, right? It's a lot like the end of Metal Gear Solid 2, where there's just too much fake information. You can't tell what's real and what's fake. So that worries me as an educator.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Mr. Icewort was impacted as an educator. You know, this is someone who is an educator himself who looked at the case of what happened in Pikesville. What do you think organizations need to do to educate their employees and in some cases, perhaps their clients like students about this so that we can be more vigilant? Mutale?
I think that there has to be deep investment in teaching critical thinking. And I always remember when I was in high school and we were first studying history, my teacher saying, you have to always look at what's written. You have to question the source of who wrote it. And you also have to then look at what was happening. So that what, who, what type, you know, made sure that we contextualized the history. We looked at whose voice it was and we looked at the words. And I think one of the things that I worry about in this particular environment that we're in, as we're dismantling the Department of Education, which benefited low-income school districts. And that's where, you know, Black and brown kids are more likely to be. I'm really worried about books being banned and the erasure of counterthought, because part of criticality is understanding lots of things could be true at the same time, understanding that things are not fair, often by design, if you're going to be structural, and then making your determinations based on that. And without criticality, I don't think that media literacy training is going to work. I don't think that technical literacy training is going to work. But this very curious and inquisitive thing, because one of the things that Ben did in his question was just like the subject matter, yes, I thought it was true. Which is an acceptance of, it's kind of taking these shortcuts that are very natural. And we need to figure out ways of helping ourselves stop that shortcut, ask a few questions, and then go back in curious and not thinking that we know the answer.
This is Midday on WYPR 88.1, and I'm your host, Farai Chidea. As we get ready to wrap up in a few minutes, I wanted to bring in Dr. Timnit Gebru, Executive Director of the Distributed AI Research Institute. And she appeared on Midday in 2023 and discussed the limited point of view that AI can lead to biases.
contrary to the belief that the internet is large and therefore it has all of our different points of view encoded, it only has really hegemonic points of view, right? Because many people don't even have the internet. And those who are on the internet, depending on, you know, who you are and what your demographic characteristics are, you can get bullied off of the internet and harassed, etc. So what remains is the hegemonic view, which then, you know, encodes biases and stereotypes, etc.
I thought of Dr. Gebru's words when you talked about counterthought. And it seems like what you're saying, both of you are saying, is that you're definitely going to have problems with an AI system and with a large language model if everything gets boiled down to, you know, a sole point of view. So where do we go from here, Mutale?
I think we have more public discussions and conversations like this so that people can understand that these are what the internet is doing is reflecting the loudest voices, as Dr. Gebru said. There's actually something called the California ideology, which is technology is always right and everybody is the same. That's not true. That's just true for a few people in California that are making these things. And if everybody's a billionaire on your block, then yes, everybody has the same things. That's not life. And then I think the other way forward is to use these technologies critically. So maybe not relying on, I'm not gonna say a brand because they all basically work in the same way. Not relying on a chatbot to write your emails because then all your emails sound the same and they say nothing and they use all the same vocabularies and, you know, the famous M-dash. People do not use M-dash in written American English. But our chatbotting, I don't even want to call them siblings, but our chatbot systems do. I think the third and final thing that we can also do is not use AI for everything, because one of the things that it does take to generate these emails and these recipes and however people are using them is that it takes data centers to be cooled down. That takes water out of communities. It can create, it can lead to air pollution. That's what's happening with Elon Musk's data center in Memphis, which is a Black city, a poor Black city, and they're not good for our environment. So I think thinking holistically about, do we have to integrate AI everywhere, or could it be really good for discovering new proteins, which is what one of the Nobel Prizes went to this year, right? That's the limited use case. It's going to be less environmental impact, less likely for bias. And then we need laws.
All right. Well, we have to wrap it up here. But Mutale, grateful that you could come. And I will be paying attention to what you do next.
Thank you so much, Farai.
That's it for today. Mutale Nkande is the CEO and founder of AI for the People and author of Automated Anti-Blackness, Why We Need to Name Race to Create Just Technological Futures. Earlier, we heard from Kristen Griffith, education reporter for the Baltimore Banner. Coming up on Monday, Tom is back and he sits down with Amanda Littman to discuss her new book, When We're in Charge, where she empowers new leadership from millennials and Gen Z. Fresh Air is up next. Stay tuned as they go out to the ballpark, revisit interviews with a few baseball Hall of Famers. Midday's audio engineer is Shania Mapson. Taria Rogers and Sam Burmes-Dawes are the producers, and they've gotten help from Melanie Pierre, Jessica Bakken, and she's the intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. I'm Farai Chidea. Thanks for joining us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.